Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Kid Hogg, Penny Hogg, at home with the Hogs.
The state of our union is strong.
At home with the Hogs.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So kind. Hola, muy buenas. How are you? And welcome to Talk Radio Europe's Expatriate Magazine. So glad you could join us today for the next 2 hours of story, satire, conversation and song on the show that has its roots not only on the costas of the Mediterranean, but also in deeper Spain. I'm Kit.
And I'm Penny. Good morning.
And talking of deep Spain, are you a campo dweller, I wonder? And have you noticed that people are getting a little bit rarer in your neck of the woods? Because we're going to be asking today how serious a problem is rural depopulation in Spain and how La España Vacía compares with the numbers of country dwellers in other parts of Europe. In a montage called The Foreboding of Spring, we look at La Primavera through the eyes of classic foreign travellers here in Spain. That's classic foreign travel writers here in Spain. And contrast the season of spring, indeed, with that of Northern Europe. And look at those very fascinating and poignant differences. At 11:35 this morning, we've got a guest, haven't we, babes?
We have Jilly Hodges is going to come in and talk to us. And she's from Samaritans in Spain. We'll be talking about what Samaritans do, what Samaritans are doing here in Spain, and how you can become a volunteer or active listener through their program or training they're going to be doing in June. So it's important stuff. It'd be great if you're there to listen.
And they've only just arrived, haven't they?
No, I think they've been in the Costa Blanca and the Torrevieja for a little while. Well, okay. We can ask Jilly.
But looking, I understand, for volunteers.
Yes.
Great. Okay. So that's at sometime around 11:35 this morning. Jilly Hodges from the Samaritans on Arbolistas Palms, Trees and Gardens. Shortly after midday, we've got a bit of a scandal brewing up in Morocco.
Well, they're trying to make something out of nothing, we can call it. The Argan Tree Goat Scandal.
Mine boggles.
Yes.
I uncover the...
Yeah, they're gluing goats to trees, are they?
Find out on Arbolistas Palms, Trees and Gardens. I uncover a beautiful calendar of Cordoba, a 10th century gardening manual, Moorish gardeners' recommendations for the month of April in El Al-Andalus, over 1,000 years ago this was written. And more currently, if you're a follower of Matthew Bennett's independent journalism postings on the Spain Report, you can't have failed to have been impressed with his prolific coverage, not only of the Catalan separatist trial, but in the last fortnight, the run-up to this country's general election, which, of course, happens tomorrow. So in the last hour of the programme, don't miss Matthew Bennett. Polls, policies, parties, personalities and predictions all in our election special from 12:30 today. And if you think you're wearing Dolce and Gabbana underpants, look again at the label. They just might be a counterfeit. A significant part of the expatriate conversation here.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Now, expats love a box set. And this week, I have to tell you that Penn and I, it's been a week of completion for us because we've finished not just one, but two box sets, haven't we, babe?
We have, yes, yes.
Both excellent.
I mean, the Fleabag was tremendous. I know you're going to talk about that now. But, what was the other one called? I've already forgotten what it's called.
Try and remember.
Yes, yes.
We spent weeks looking at it.
Denimora and Sugar. No? What is it called?
It's called Escape at Denimora.
Ah, yes. Yeah, and you don't sleep very well after it, I found that particular.
Well, it's obviously affected your memory. Yeah, they say that sleep and memory are connected.
Take a lot but to anyway, affect my memory.
Escape at Denimora. Have you seen it? It's directed by Ben Stiller. It's a gritty, true story about two guys convicted for murder breaking out of an upstate New York penitentiary. It's kind of like a, reminding me of a Richard Marx song. It's sort of compellingly saturated in blue-collar realism, the whiff of self-pity that somehow saturates Americana, and a bit of an inevitable
self-pity.
Conclusion.
Why self-pity?
That kind of sentiment that runs through country and western. You know, my dog died and life is just...
It's pretty tough to be in a penitentiary, I would say, but...
It's very tough, yeah. But the whole heaviness of it.
It was very heavy. Yes, yes.
Quite addictive, actually. It was like a sort of over-rich pudding, I thought.
Yes, and surprising in some ways. Anyway, it's really worth a watch.
Yeah, very nice. That's Escape at Denimora, if you haven't seen it. And by the way, if you're watching a great box set, please let us know, because we're a sucker for box sets. We try and...
We don't go out much, do we?
We don't go out much, no. We sit at home and take supplements. The other one, if you haven't seen it, as Pengy said, it's as simply brilliant must, as British as you like. It's called Fleabag. It's written, starred and directed by the dazzling Phoebe Waller-Bridge. If you haven't already seen it, do. Particularly if you're a woman with a sister. Because Phoebe's relationship with her sister is so consummately observed as to be almost impenetrable. It's incestuous emotionality, intimate to the point of being autoimmune, arcanely and incomprehensibly female.
Incomprehensibly? What do you mean?
As a bloke watching the relationship between those two women, you sit there mesmerised, but it's like they're in a membrane, impenetrable.
What about the stepmother? How can you read that whole...
She was equally weird.
Right, the female thing, okay.
And the thing about that show is that everybody's so bright and so finely tuned. But the women especially. It gave me total empathy with the late Stephen Hawking, who confessed shortly before dying that of all the mysteries of the universe that his incandescent mind had unravelled, that of woman remained beyond him. Now, talking of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, I wonder if you've seen Killing Eve, because we haven't, and...
The title puts me off.
Yes.
I like to sleep, not after something that is killing. You would assume it involves a murder or something.
You don't know who Eve is. Eve might be a computer or something inanimate.
Okay.
Anyway, that's what we're going to try and watch next, purely because she wrote it. Now, I forgot to ask you, did you order the goat poo?
Well, it's difficult to say what I've ordered.
Goat poo, by the way, the reason we want goat poo is dry goat poo is the most fantastic fertiliser for all the new trees we've been planting.
Yes,
Estiércol de cabra.
Estiércol de cabra. So I rang the goat farm, which you go past on the way back to our house, and I thought I'd put in an order for one lorry load of Estiércol de cabra.
Splendid.
No problem. And they said,
it hasn't turned up yet. Is that a goat?
That was not actually. It's the guy at the other end of the other phone who turns out to be the padre of Juan.
You be the man, I'll be the goats in the background.
No, okay. Stop it. So I said, ¿cuándo vale por el camión? He said, un millón. I said, a million? I said, I think he thought I was ordering a whole lorry load of goat's cheese, which is what they make there. So I don't think we've got a whole lorry load of goat's cheese arriving. So next week we'll see what happens.
Did you use the word queso?
No, not at all. No.
Ah. So something was lost in translation.
Something's definitely lost in translation. So it was a little... little bit.
Okay.
It's Andalus as well.
We'll see
and
what
age.
Turns up. Yeah. All right, so talking of cheese and manure, how empty is the Spanish Campo becoming?
Well,
we had a bit of a scare, didn't we? Let's just talk about our little scare. Because our pueblo used to have two banks and then Cajamar shut, didn't it?
It did.
And
then there's a rumor flying.
And then Unicaja has been suspiciously short-staffed, hasn't it? There's one guy, Jaime, who's on his own there pretty much.
Yes. I actually have asked him directly. I said, is this bank about to close? He said, no. It isn't. So...
Oh, so where did that rumour come from?
It came from a source.
Because it's the beginning of the...
You can't say what the source is.
It's top secret.
Yeah,
it's the beginning of the disintegration of local services, isn't it? That,
yeah.
That is eroding local communities
all over
Spain.
It is, but so you listen to this about Sayaton, which is a village which is just north of Madrid. I mean, an hour's drive. So when Maria Angeles Rosado first arrived in Sayaton two decades ago, it was a home to 150 people, had a shop, a bar, and even a daily bus service to Madrid and Guadalajara. Today, its population has dwindled to just 50 people, 7 children, a big bar, a pharmacy, the two obviously always go together, and that's all that remains of the town's glories. And... she says the doctor and nurse come for one hour on Tuesday mornings. The butcher comes once a month. The fruit and veg guy comes once a week, and so does the frozen food guy. And there used to be someone who came to sell household cleaning products, but not anymore. So she took a selfie of herself in the cab of her tractor one morning, and she wrote, "Finishing up the sewing, mother. Young farmer in Sayaton, where there's no school or paediatrician and only a doctor for an hour a week. And here we are, a smile on our face, growing food for the world." So this was a tweet. But the tweet soon found a larger audience, as well as getting more than 4,000 retweets, which I think means sending on, and 15,000 likes. It's made her a minor celebrity and helped focus attention of Sayaton and the wider problems of depopulation, which I think have become quite a political issue as well with the election coming up, hasn't it?
Well, they have, yes. Partly because 99 out of the 350 seats up for grabs in tomorrow's election are from depopulated rural areas, and traditionally they were always from the PP, the Partido Popular, which is now under attack from two other votes. There's now three right-of-centre parties instead of just one. And so there has been, I think, a disproportionate amount of campaigning for these seats, which are seen as sort of cherries by the right-of-centre parties, Vox and Ciudadanos and PP.
Okay. Well, we could talk to Matthew about that.
Yeah, later. We'll see what Matthew Bennett has to say in our election special shortly after 12:30 today. And there was a big demonstration recently. I just quote you an article I read in The Economist. They come from medieval villages, the colour of harsh surrounding land, from the Spain of transhuman shepherds, lonely sierras and forests of oak. They're quietly angry. On March the 31st, some 50,000 of them marched through the centre of Madrid in what they called the Rebellion of Emptied Out Spain. Their placards and banners displayed the poetry of place names. Their demands were prosaic. Villa Mayor del Rio wants a pharmacy. Orihuela de Tremedal needs faster internet. Aranda del Duero demands better infrastructure. Almansa resists. Wild Fuentes de Bejar exists. We feel a bit abandoned. We need doctors, said Paula Siles, a social care worker from La Paras de Castellote, population 57, down from 86 in 2004, in the Maestrazgo Mountains of Teruel. I wonder what that must be like actually to be in a village that is slowly disappearing in terms of its populace.
A bit lonely, I'd say.
Yeah, yes. I mean,
well, you'd be tempted to leg it yourself, really.
It's like what happened to the Garcias. Oh, they moved. Didn't you know? I went past their place. It was empty. My goodness. But actually, there's a best-selling book called La España Vacía by a guy called Sergio del Molino, who argues that Spain was never full.
Yeah, it's a big country.
Yes, but you see this in countries where the coasts always attract the population, particularly in these latitudes. I mean, Australia obviously was settled very much later than Spain, but nobody lives in the middle of Australia. Everyone lives around the edge.
Yeah, near water, basically.
Brazil.
Old communications.
The majority of people live in Brazil live near the coast. He says Spain was never full and that the demographic imbalance is ancient. Those who leave for the cities do so in search of opportunities that village life can never offer. And even though areas around Teruel and Soria are losing their rural infrastructure at an untenable rate, a survey in El Mundo newspaper found as many as 26.1% of Spaniards still live in the campo, pueblo, and small towns. That they're basically country dwellers. And this is just below the European average, only just below the European average, which is 27.3%. And by comparison, what percentage of people live in the English countryside of the total English population? What would you guess, babe?
Do you know already?
Yes, I do know. I've got it written down.
Just tell me then. Don't ask me to guess. I've no idea.
Just not playing this morning, are you? Only 12%, which is...
Okay.
Here in Spain, we have 26% of people still resident in the country. Only 12%.
Surely a lot of that can be... I would attribute that to agricultural machinery. You don't need labourers. You don't need people actually working on the land. Something has changed agriculturally, I would have thought, that has produced that. And the fact that you can't make a lot of money out of agriculture, surely. And that's where...
Well, you need less people.
You need less people.
Yes, when you've got agribusiness. And one suspects there is more agribusiness. Another comparison that's interesting between England and Spain is you're talking about a village an hour north of Madrid that is suffering...
1 hour.
1 hour north of Madrid that is suffering depopulation. Yeah. Can you imagine a village 1 hour north of London suffering depopulation? I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it? I mean, you're in the sort of still in the riches of the home counties, places like Marlow, which we talked about last week. It's just unthinkable.
It is, yes, but it's a lot to do with geography, surely.
It's exactly to do with geography, yes, and the fact that a load of people live in the southeast of England and actually in the centre of Spain, everybody's congregated in pretty much the metropolitan area of Madrid. Just going back to European averages of country dwellers. Lithuania is the country where most people live in the country. 55% of the population of Lithuania still living the good life. And the island of Malta, interestingly, is the most urbanized. Actually, it's not that interesting because Malta's obviously very small. There's not a lot of country anyway. And nearly everybody lives in La Valletta, which is the capital. I want to talk about something completely different now. Something that's been on my mind and
just
in another part
mind,
of my
hey?
Anatomy. Yeah, it's like having a pebble in your shoe. There's really very little as irritating as ill-fitting underwear. And mine has inherited this tendency of late. Now, what's curious here is that I'll be putting on my underpants of a morning and they'll be close-fitting and snug. And then on a typical day, by about 3 in the afternoon, the sort of slippage has occurred. I mean, close-fitting, snug, no longer, essential support absent. The budgie is escaping the budgie smugglers. So one of two things has happened. Stop laughing, I'm going to turn you down. One of two things has happened. Either I've changed shape over the course of the morning or my underpants have. So before removing them in a cubicle somewhere and going commando, I check the label. And they were Dolce & Gabbana. They certainly were the last time I looked in a cursory way. But on closer inspection on this occasion, they weren't Dolce & Gabbana at all. They were called Dulce & Camino.
Camino,
yes.
Right.
Well, Cecilia, it looks like Dolce & Gabbana in the cursory look, but actually, cleverly...
I think this is related to your lack of glasses. Recently.
That's right. Yes, yeah. Yes. Thank you for finding my glasses, by the way. It's made a big difference. So anyway, piqued by the discovery that I'm wearing a pair of ill-fitting underpants called Dulce and Camino, I rummaged in the briefs department of my wardrobe cupboard in search for the Calvin Kleins that I'm sure I possessed. But guess what? Now that I'm looking, Calvin's got nothing to do with them at all. They're labelled Galvan Kane. And of course, they retail, and this is why they retail at 15% of the real thing. So you get what you pay for. Beware of Galvin Kane, gentlemen. They fade into shapeless ineffectuality by tea time, slippage, and unattractive hoiking. So underpants have strange names, don't they?
Yes, I think we could go and get you some more this afternoon.
I mean, I've got a pair of underpants called Dim.
Yes, you can get those in Carrefour. I think it's excellent.
I mean, whoever thought of Dim, for goodness sake, for a pair of underpants? I've also got a pair of underpants. I mean, I actually went into my cupboard this morning and looked at...
Does this mean that branding matters to you?
No, not so much. It's just the whole genre of what you call a pair of underpants. You release a pair of male underpants on there. They used to be called jockeys or something like that, didn't they? Now they're called...
Dim.
Check this out. Dim. Whoever thought of that? I mean, even in Spanish, DIM, D-I-M, it must stand for something. I've got a pair of underpants called District 51.
Those are the best ones.
Where's District 51, for goodness sake? Hip-hop. Right. Urban Edge. And do you know why I think these labels exist?
Tell me.
Do you remember about 3 or 4 years ago that phase of young men who refused to pull up their jeans? So they walk around with their jeans sagging almost below their buttocks.
Below the buttocks, yeah.
And so the label of the underpants was visible.
That's why people decided to call them Dim.
Very good. Good call. I would call him Dim as well. Now, while we're on the subject of counterfeits, have you been recently, I wonder, approached by an Italian driving a small hire car? Always on the forecourt of a filling station, he'll screech to a halt, in a fluster, yell at you from his open window, and he's basically lost. This is his thing. He's lost, and he's looking for somewhere.
Sounds like a bit of a Swiss to me.
It's all slightly unintelligible because he's speaking Italian at this point. So you go over to the car, and you kind of lean in the front window and say, look, you speak Spanish to him, thinking that he'll understand Spanish. And then he starts to speak English because he realizes you're English. And he says, oh, by the way, I've got this quality socket set that I'm giving away for ridiculously little money. Caramba, I'm so generous. I must be going mad. And there, on the passenger seat next to him, is indeed a pristine new tray of gleaming sockets. Chinese counterfeit sockets. No thanks. It's 5 p.m. My underwear is irritating. And I've been bitten before. This occurred in a service station near Algeciras years ago. I paid way too many pesetas to another Italian for a splendid-looking Nikon camera. Except as he drove off, I noticed that it wasn't actually a Nikon. It was a Nokon. O instead of I. Nokon, it was an absolute con. It simply didn't work. The moral here, read the label. Sunglasses, make sure the bargain pair of Oakleys you're about to buy aren't Jokleys.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they?
What time is it?
I don't know. I'll check. Spring, wake up! Everybody, it's springtime! Spring is here!
Spring is here, spring is here, spring is here, spring is here.
Spring is here?
Spring is here?
Spring is finally here.
With the snow and ice no longer seen.
The leaves are finally turning green.
That's why it's time to sing.
Spring is finally here.
Great job, everybody. So spring is here. En abril, aguas mil. En abril, aguas mil. It's a refrain or saying spoken at this most treasured time of year, la primavera. Aguas mil, literally, a thousand waters, as indeed deluged Javier on Monday. But in normal seasons, an obvious reference to the rain that soaks its blessing onto budding trees and flowers, that final top-up for rivers, wells and watercourses before the aridity of the summer bake. The joy of the blossoming landscape. Few places do wildflowers like the Med. It's echoed in gardens giddy with the scent of jasmine and orange blossom. And of course, it's celebrated in fiesta in spite of the relative clemency of a Spanish winter. La primavera is a traditional fount of alegría, of happiness. The risen Christ of Semana Santa. The feria of bullfights in Seville. The pilgrimage of El Rocío. And on April the 25th, last Thursday, the day of the patron saint of bulls, Saint Mark, who is not only the patron saint of bulls, but of all the animals that graze God's pastures, the mellow, methane-farting, cud-chewing herbivores. Here's Gerald Brennan writing about St. Mark's Day in 1922 in his adopted pueblo of Yegan in the Alpujarras.
It is on his day, therefore, that they are brought to be blessed. A procession was formed behind his wooden image, everyone needing his cow or goat or mule or donkey, each with a bunch of flowers tied to his horn or ear, and the shepherds and goat herds driving their herds in front of them. In this manner, the whole animal population was brought through the narrow streets to the church square, where the priest, turning round, blessed and incensed them. As soon as this had been done, small bracelet-shaped rolls of bread known as roscoes were distributed, one for each person and animal. They were the gift of a confraternity whose members drew lots each year as to which one of them was to provide the flour and make them. After being blessed by the priest, they were hung on the horns of the cows and goats and over the ears of the donkeys, and the procession resumed its march through the lower barrio. Other roscoes were handed round to friends and relatives to whom they were believed to bring luck. And at the end of the day, each of the animals was given a piece. In our village, with its steep, crooked streets, no sight was more picturesque or pagan-seeming than this procession of many sorts of animals decorated with flowers and led by their owners, old men, women and children.
And here, replete in the bounty of La Primavera, as long ago as 1832, is Washington Irving, American adventurer and diplomat, author of Tales of the Alhambra, from which this reading comes. And he's having a picnic. What luxurious noontide repasts we have made on the greensward by the side of a brook, of a fountain, under a shady tree, and what delicious siestas on our cloaks spread out on the herbage. We paused one day at noon for a repast of the kind. It was a pleasant little green meadow surrounded by hills covered with olive trees. Our cloaks were spread on the grass under an elm tree by the side of a bubbling rivulet. Our horses were tethered where they might crop the herbage. And Sancho produced his alforjas, that's a saddlebag, with an air of triumph. They contained the contributions of 4 days' journeying that had been signally enriched by the foraging of the previous evening in a plenteous inn at Antequera. Our squire drew forth the heterogeneous contents one by one. And these consisted of, firstly, a shoulder of roasted kid, very little the worse for wear, then an entire partridge, then a great morsel of salted codfish wrapped in paper, then the residue of a ham, and then half of a pullet, together with several rolls of bread and a rabble-rout of oranges, figs, raisins, and walnuts. His butter also had been recruited with some excellent wine of Malaga, at every fresh apparition from his larder, he would enjoy a ludicrous surprise, throwing himself back on the grass and shouting with laughter. Nothing pleased the simple-hearted varlet more than to be compared for his devotion to the trencher to the well-renowned squire of Don Quixote. He was well-versed in the history of Don Quixote, and, like most of the common people in Spain, firmly believed it to be a true history. Talking of spring, my brother Gavin called me from Wales the other day in an unusually good mood. Indeed, he sounded happy, effervescently so. Now, this may be due to the recent completion of what, in the depths of winter, seemed like an interminable renovation of his kitchen, but I think his elevation of mood had more to do with sun-kissed daffodils, symphonic birdsong, and air that tastes of blossom. Spring, in other words. And in order to understand his unbridled liberation and boundless joy, try to remember quite how grim a northern winter is. Tundra-grey, marrow-chilling days of pervading damp that lose interest in themselves and peter out at 4 p.m. into unwelcome evenings. Month-long head colds exacerbated by claustrophobic central heating and hours of indigestion in front of indifferent telly. The mid-Feb morale drop, when your loss of the will to live becomes palpable, diminished further by the sight of your own lily-white legs floating in front of you in the bath like parsnips. And you know this to be true because you've seen the English here at Easter blinking in the brightness. They look like winter vegetables. So, do you remember that first smell of spring back in Blighty? An ecstasy of relief. It almost ignites your heart. You don't really get it here, what with the almond blossom already illuminating the landscape by January. Because Spanish spring, though celebrated in April, actually plays out over 2 or 3 months. Winter masquerades as spring, and vice versa. It's a seductive and beautiful season, this gradual southern spring, but it comes with a certain foreboding, a premonition. Because whereas a northern spring heralds a soft, deciduous, endlessly hospitable summer, a maturing of spring indeed, here El Verano lies in wait to prey on the lushness of May, to shrivel, to turn to dust, to desiccate. And that is why La Primavera is a glory unto itself, its own culmination, like the exquisite poignancy of Japanese cherry blossom in a metaphor for death. The florid Mediterranean spring is not enhanced by summer. It's extinguished by it. Look no further than the wild campo plant, the Ergene, humble gorse, which, since February, has graced our landscape in verdant greens and bright yellows, but which, within the first weeks of hot summer, sucks its sap back into its roots and becomes a dry, grey mass of spines as hospitable as a roll of barbed wire. This hibernation is counterintuitive to the northern ideal of summer, where plants and birds, having flowered and sang in spring, hang out and celebrate. It's a sort of fulfilment. Here, they wither and go silent because La Primavera is its own fulfilment. Come July, Iberia is as inhospitable as a German January. The juice of spring baked dry by summer. Here's Richard Ford from his Guide to Spain during the summer of 1838. And then when the heavens and earth are on fire and the sun drinks up the rivers in one drought, when one burnt sienna tone pervades the tawny ground and the green herb is shriveled up into black gunpowder and the rare pale ashy olive trees are blanched into the livery of the desert, then when the heat and harshness make even the salamander muleteers swear doubly as they toil along like demons in an ignited salitrode dust, then indeed will an Englishman discover that he is made of the same material, only drier, and learn to estimate water. But a good thirst is too serious an evil, too bordering on suffering, to be made, like an appetite, a matter of congratulation. For when all fluids evaporate and the blood thickens into currant jelly and the nerves tighten up into the catgut of an overstrung fiddle, getting attuned to the porcupinal irritability of the tension of the mind, how the parched soul sights for the comfort of a Scotch mist and fondly turns back to the relaxing damps of Devon. In a yearning for water, relieve your thirst with Camarón de la Isla. Welcome back. Lovely to have you with us, and lovely to have Gilly Hodges, who's from Samaritans in Spain, and she's come in to see us this morning. Gilly, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Gilly. I gather Samaritans have started here in Spain. Is that a recent development, or has it been...
We've had Samaritans in Spain for a few years now.
Oh, yeah.
Just an English-speaking service for the expats and anybody English-speaking in Spain.
Yes.
And it covers the whole of Spain and the islands.
Wow. Wow, that's quite a big task. That's a big geographical area.
It is, yes.
And one of the reasons you're coming in today is because you're going to be recruiting new volunteers.
Yes, we're hoping to. We're going to run a training for listening volunteers beginning in June.
Okay, excellent.
Three Saturdays in June.
Right, okay. So what about, can we talk about how the, first of all, Samaritans and what you do and your history, well, not your history.
I was a Samaritan in the UK for 10 years.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it very much, if you can say that, because, you know, I met a lot of lovely people, and the community of the Samaritans is a great community to be a part of.
Really?
Yes, really, it is.
Well, as a volunteer?
As a volunteer, certainly, yes.
How does it function as a community?
Well,
when you say it's a community?
The community of volunteers have to be emotionally stable themselves in order to give emotional support to the public.
That must be quite difficult to find volunteers then. Who's emotionally stable these days, she said.
yes, you're in a minority there.
But the support that you get from each other whilst you're taking these calls, which can be quite distressing at times.
Of course.
And the support we get from each other is second to none, really.
Really? Really? Yeah. Okay.
It's a lovely, lovely operation to be a part of, to be honest.
Wow, and it can become a bit... Well, let's start with how Samaritans actually began. Was that... It's like, well, way back in the 50s, wasn't
it? Yes, it was early 50s, and it was a gentleman called...
Chad Vara.
And he was a clergyman, and he was very distressed to have to conduct a funeral for a 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. Who had died because she had her first period and thought she was dying. So she had no idea.
She took her life?
She took her own life, yes. And he realised that there was a need for people to have confidential conversations, and so that's what he wanted to supply.
Okay, and, so, that started in the church?
Yes, although we don't have any religious connections at all.
Okay.
Samaritans isn't a religious organisation.
Right.
So how did Chad let it be known that he was available to listen?
He told his congregation that every Tuesday night he would be available between these hours. And what happened, people started queuing up to talk to somebody in confidence. And during that...
Oh, well, face-to-face.
Face-to-face.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. This was face-to-face. And during that time, he had some ladies in his congregation supply tea and cake and things to the people waiting in the queue before they got to him. Huh. And they found that gradually the queue was dispersing because all these people wanted to do was talk to somebody, and they were talking to the ladies who were giving them tea.
So
that's how it started.
So Chad was sitting in his office.
Yes, no, waiting for the next one.
They were all outside eating.
They're all gone.
Yeah. Drinking tea. Yeah,
there's nothing like a piece of cake, is there?
So he decided then that actually a telephone support line would be perfect for these people who wanted to just talk and they needed somebody to listen without judgment and in complete confidentiality.
Okay.
And so he started the telephone line, and now there are 21,000 volunteers in the UK.
That's a lot of people.
Yes.
That's a lot of people.
Who give some time voluntarily every week or every fortnight. It might just be 4 hours, yeah, and listen to people without judging them.
So when you say listen, I mean, that is part of one of the principles of being a Samaritan, isn't it?
Yes, people associate Samaritans with suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And we always will discuss suicide with people.
Mm.
And we get calls from just lonely people, distressed people, angry people, but also suicidal people.
Mm-hmm.
And people have to understand that we will keep their confidence, whatever, within Samaritans. We mm-hmm. won't share what they tell us.
Okay.
And that's so important because people don't want to talk to their friends or family if they're feeling suicidal because they don't want to be rescued at that point. They just want to talk.
Okay. If you call the Samaritans, can you ask for a particular person?
No.
So it is impersonal?
Yes, we all answer the telephone in exactly the same way. We're all trained in the same way. And
have you spoken to the same person more than once?
Yes, we do. But
they would call you?
Well, it would just be coincidence.
Coincidentally.
If we did.
Yes. Okay. You can't ask for a particular volunteer.
No, we don't.
And presumably you don't say your name?
No.
No, okay. No.
I mean, say a name if we wanted, but we like to keep ourselves anonymous.
Okay.
As well.
I'm interested in this concept of active listening.
Mm-hmm.
Describe active listening.
That's very difficult to do. It's quite a long training that we do, but
what are the elements of it?
What we're trying to ask questions in a way that they can try and solve their own problems through the questions we're asking.
Wow.
We can't give advice and we don't give advice, but we try and get our callers to see things in a slightly different way.
By questioning them?
Yes. Sometimes it is by questioning and discussing and asking them what they think, what options they think they have.
Do you have to keep your own personality and views out of that?
Yes.
Okay.
So yes,
hence the training.
You're stepping back, aren't you?
Yes.
Well,
empathy is trying to get down into that hole that somebody's in and feeling what they're feeling. And we discuss feelings a lot. You know, that is what we do. How are you feeling about something is a question we ask a lot. We try not to challenge them in any way. We would very rarely use the word why, but how does that make you feel? Or, you know, that sort of mm-hmm. question.
How easy is it to get a sense of quite how desperate somebody is? I mean, you how long have you been doing this, Gillian?
About 12 years.
And you speak on average to people how often? How many times a week are you engaged
at
in this
moment,
work?
At the moment, about once a week for a 4-hour shift.
Okay. So you're pretty tuned in to quite, I go back to this question of how desperate somebody is. You must be pretty tuned in to their vulnerability. and their state.
Yes, I have.
How fragile they are.
Sometimes people can hide it very well. Sometimes people will start off a conversation and sound very happy and very content, and in the end it's absolutely the opposite to that. So it's by the questions we ask and how we ask them and gaining their trust and the empathy we show them that we start to actually dig deeper into their true feelings at that time.
Mm.
Some people, it's very obvious. As soon as they ring, if they're very upset, you know, it can be obvious.
Mm. And so the elements then of listening are confidentiality.
Very important.
Non-judgmental.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
But also non-religious.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Yes.
If
somebody wants to talk to us about religion or their beliefs, that's absolutely fine, but we won't give any opinion or show our religion,
right,
or if we have one, or beliefs, but we'll discuss
that. So this method of active listening must be effective.
It is.
It is effective. And how do you know it is? I mean, do people ring back and say, yeah, I'm okay now? Or, I mean, that sounds frivolous, I know, but how is it by the end of a conversation you feel that you've managed to detune a sort of very volatile situation or very upset situation? Do you get an idea yourself or oneself as a volunteer that things might have improved for that person?
Sometimes we do, and it's lovely when we do. It's a really nice thing to hear.
Yes.
But we never ask for any feedback in that way, because we're not trying to make ourselves feel better.
That's
by
true.
Doing this.
Yes, yes,
and
yeah.
That's
how did
important.
I do? You don't want any of that stuff.
No,
God, aren't I good? Yeah.
No.
Gillian, Penn, we've actually got a caller on the line who we're going to take. Hi, good morning. You're live on Talk Radio Europe.
Hello, I'm just saying, as a matter of interest for you, Chad Barra used to have a Samaritan's talk programme on Radio Luxembourg in the 50s.
Did he? Did he?
Yeah,
did
I
you?
Did.
Did you know about that?
No,
Jimmy?
I wasn't aware of that.
And you listen to him, yes?
Yes, I did. Yes, because in those days we all used to listen to Radio Luxembourg, and he
did.
Was on the regular.
Oh, okay, well, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Yes, we're talking about it being effective and how you know. Not that you need to know, but that's interesting, you know, how it... Which brings me to... I mean, one of the reasons you're here this morning is we're going to talk about hopefully be able to get some more people who'd be willing to consider volunteering.
Yeah.
But... debriefing, or after you've done a shift, which you're asking people for their time commitment of about four hours every fortnight.
Yes.
Yeah. So say you've been doing a shift on the telephone and talking to someone, you've had your training. How is that volunteer supported? How does it work for the volunteer who might have had to take in a lot of that person's grief or energy themselves?
Absolutely. When you finish your training, you have a mentor, so you don't do...
Oh, okay.
You don't do a shift alone on the telephone at all.
Right.
So you'd have a mentor, and you would listen to them taking calls, and you'd be involved that way. And when you are ready, and only when you feel ready, you would start taking calls with your mentor there. And that mentorship could go on. It might just be a month. It might be 6 months until the volunteer is really happy. And after that, after every shift, they debrief every single call back to their mentor or another person in the group, because it's so confidential. You can't even tell your husband or partner or son or anything about the calls.
Really?
No.
Really?
And we have to be this way, because then, you know, we have that reputation.
Of course, it's about trust, isn't it?
Yes.
But you can talk to other Samaritans.
You must talk.
You must,
you
yes.
must.
Because
yes.
otherwise you're bearing it, aren't
yes.
you?
Yes.
You've got it sort of contained, the stress. Yes. And the...
And even if you have no calls, we say to our volunteers on the debrief, how do you feel about getting no calls? Because actually, you've given up your 4 hours of your time and nobody's phoned. And sometimes that might make you feel, well, why am I doing this?
Well, it's a bit like running a radio show.
Yes. Hello. Hopefully not quite so desperate.
How is the situation here in Spain?
There are a lot of people who call us.
Yes, and so you're dealing with the expatriate community.
Yes, we are.
And so do you have Spanish speakers? Are the Samaritans intending to get into helping Spanish people?
No, this is just for English speaking people.
Is there an equivalent here in Spain?
There is a crisis line that if somebody rang with who wanted to speak Spanish, we will put them onto a different telephone.
Oh, that's loose. There's
I don't think they run exactly the same as the Samaritans, but it is for people in crisis.
Right. Okay. So, say I was thinking of becoming a volunteer myself.
Oh, good, Penny. When can we start?
You're emotionally stable. Being emotionally stable. Mm-hmm. How would I go about it?
Well, the best thing to do is email or telephone Samaritans in Spain, which is the head office. Which is in Torrevieja.
Okay, and so you'd get the email address through www.samaritansinspain.com.
Yes.
And presumably this is either if you want to volunteer or if you need to call the Samaritans, you'd start in at that same website.
The Samaritan helpline.
Yes.
Is a free phone and it's
900
525 100.
100, 900, 525, 100. Because, of course, not everybody has the internet, do they?
No, of course not. And that is that you will get through to a Samaritan, a listening volunteer.
Lovely.
So anybody who needs to talk about anything, you don't have to be suicidal to call the Samaritan.
Yeah, if you just...
Well, particularly if you want to be a volunteer.
Yeah. particularly if you're lonely.
We'll be giving that number out again before the end of the programme.
Yeah. Thank you.
Julie, that I'm afraid is all we have time for.
Thank you very much.
Julie Hodges from Samaritan. It's been absolutely brilliant. Coming up in the next hour on Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens, gardening in 10th century Cordoba, the hidden benefits of the willow tree, and are Moroccan goats being forced into argan trees? Oh, and there's a small matter of a general election tomorrow. Prescient punditry from Matthew Bennett of the Spain Report. You wanted to say something about...
Yes, I do. We'll be giving out the dates of the training just after the news.
Yes, absolutely. We'll see you then. Bye-bye now. Broadcasting to 500,000 people from me, Bill Eriks, to Jib. You're in good company on Talk Radio. You're your friend at the weekend. We're with Julie Hodges from the Samaritans in Spain. Julie, you're looking for volunteers, aren't you?
Yes.
To become a Samaritan here in basically expatria, yeah?
Yes.
How's the Costa? Yeah, you've got people at the moment working where? In the Balearics, in the Costa Blanca?
We've got Torrevieja. We've
yes.
got a satellite branch in Madrid. We're the second satellite branch, and there are some others being set up at the moment around Spain and hopefully in Mallorca, I think.
Right.
So on the 6th of June, you have a meeting in Sota Grande Port, is that right?
Yes, if anybody wants any more information, on Monday the 3rd of June at 7 in the evening, we will be in Sota Grande Port at the Lemon Cafe, which is next to the Hairy Lemon pub.
The Hairy
There's
Lemon.
A lot of lemons going on down there.
Yes, the Lemon Cafe, which is next to the Hairy Lemon
pub. The Hairy Lemon, right.
And I will be there and can talk to anybody and give them just information to see if they're interested.
Okay. What time of day is that?
That's at 7 in the evening.
7 in the evening, okay.
It could just be an hour. Very informal chat.
Okay, and so then after that...
Anybody who's interested will fill in an application form and come back to the same place on the 6th of June, which is the Thursday, at 6:30.
Yes.
And that we will then select the people to train.
Right. Describe the training.
The training will be over 3 Saturdays in June.
That's the first one. So that would be the following Saturday, wouldn't it? It'll be the 8th.
The 8th, the 15th and the 22nd.
Of June.
It'll be from 10 in the morning till 3. Right. And that will be in the Duquesa area.
Okay, excellent.
And describing the training is quite difficult. It's 10 modules of training, and we talk about suicide, about people's right to self-determination, because if somebody is suicidal and they are determined, we don't try and dissuade them. Our job is to listen to their thoughts. In training, I use a great analogy, which is like a tumble dryer. And those are your thoughts, with all the clothes are your thoughts. Mm. And we like to take everyone out, fold it, put it on top of the dryer. So we haven't changed your life, but we might have put your thoughts into a better order.
Mm. Cleaning out an old cupboard?
Yes. Because sometimes when you're upset and distressed, it's like a pressure in your head, isn't it? And somebody needs to relieve that valve to allow you to think clearly.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter what you say. Presumably, you know, as if you're calling in, so it's got to not matter what you say.
No, it does not matter what you say.
So, no, I like the analogy of a tumble dryer because it's moving, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like churning.
Yes.
Loop of churning unhappiness.
Yeah. And although we don't give advice, a lot of people say to us at the end of it, thank you for the advice. Mm. We haven't actually given them advice, but in their head, they've given themselves advice. It's sorted them out.
Aren't you resolving complications, really? I mean, if somebody's so muddled, so confused, so complicated that they actually want to take their own life, are you in a way dissolving those structures?
We're not resolving. We're allowing them to resolve them for themselves. I mean, although we believe in self-determination, in other words, we won't stop somebody if that's their decision, our vision is that fewer people die from suicide. That's what we want. And we hope that somebody who might present being very suicidal, at the end, if they're not, well, we've done our job.
How many people who call you are actually suicidal?
That's very difficult to say. There are...
You can't ask them that, really, can you?
We ask every single person who calls if they're feeling suicidal.
Oh, do you?
Because we would be... People expect that. Samaritans is renowned for being a suicide line, although that's not all that we do. And sometimes we fail people if we don't give them the opportunity to discuss suicide.
Mm.
But if somebody tells us that they're suicidal, we will actually talk about it. There aren't very many people who will do that with you, you know?
Because it's such a drastic thing.
It's a huge subject and one that people shy away from.
So what will you be looking for? What are the characteristics, is it possible to say, that you might be looking for in a potential volunteer?
It's difficult to say exactly what we want, but somebody who is very willing to learn and be trained, how to listen. We all believe that we can listen, but a lot of us listen but don't hear. And this is all a part of the training. And we listen for key words and trigger words and things that alert us to the state of somebody's mind.
Yes, how lovely to learn to listen. I mean, so we're so bad at listening, particularly here in Spain, actually. I think it's possibly something to do with
training and not be a volunteer.
but to actually learn to listen.
I quite fancy that, yeah.
I mean, so how often are you talking to someone? You probably not, but when I'm talking to someone and I realise that I'm actually glazing over because I'm not particularly interested or my mind is elsewhere, to be clear enough and centred enough, to actually listen takes training.
Yeah,
it's something we're not used to. We're much more interested in our own noise, aren't we?
And so many people say it has changed their everyday life just doing the training.
Being a volunteer, really?
Yes.
And not, part of that community and stuff.
But also the skills they've learned and they put into their everyday life, not just into their listening time.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said that people have told me that their children are. Actually, you're listening to me, you know, whereas you're normally doing something else. And it changes people's relationships within the family, having done the training. It's quite fascinating.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right.
So
anyway,
age,
so yes,
any
I'd love
age,
it.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't, you know, we want a diverse listening crew, really. as diverse as possible.
For sure.
Okay, and is there any age, say, between sort of 20, 85 or 90, male, female, sexuality, irrelevant?
Yeah. Brilliant. Transgender, anything, we do not judge, neither our volunteers nor our callers.
Perfect. And so if you're interested in becoming a volunteer, please get in touch with Samaritans in Spain.
Let's have that phone number again, babes.
And that's 900... 525-100 is the helpline. 900-525-100. Thank you so much, Gillie.
Thank you for having me. Really lovely to talk to you.
Yes, it's been absolutely lovely having you.
Thank you.
And the very best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, I'm in this hour, Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens, and the Spanish election.
At home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
And scatter the good seed on the land, but it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. He sends the snow in winter, the worms to smell the grain, the breezes and the sunshine and soft refreshing rain.
Yes, and welcome to another episode of Arbalista's Palms, Trees and Gardens. Good afternoon. 952 78 4000 is the number to call in case you want to get involved. Recent publication I've discovered called Granada, The Light of Andalusia by a guy called Stephen Nightingale. Lovely book. Do recommend it. But and within it, I found this beautiful passage, it's from a splendid book, 10th century book, actually. Amazing, eh? 10th century, it's over 1,000 years old. It's called The Calendar of Cordoba, and it shows us the work on the land according to the Christian calendar months with the Syriac and Coptic names of each. And apparently a wonderful read. Not only do we have details on the times of sunrise and sunset, the constellations and even the length of twilight, but we've got a delicious and persuasive description of life on the land. But before I begin, I'm going to break and take this phone call. Hello, you're live on TRE. Oh, I've got to click the thing first. Hello, you're live on TRE. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to thank you very much for that talk about the Samaritans and that lovely lady. Thank you for that.
Yes.
I phoned the 900 number and
yes.
I spoke to a lady.
Excellent.
And she took my email address.
Yes.
And she said that she would write to me. She was in the Costa Blanca, I think she said she was.
Oh, okay.
I live in Nerja, so she said she would get somebody to talk to me or to write to me.
Oh,
I just want
excellent.
I just want to thank you for that. It was really, really wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, absolute pleasure. And she is a lovely lady. And I tell you, if you ever have any hesitation about picking up that phone, drop it. Drop that hesitation because she's very, very easy to talk to. Thanks for your call.
Well, I just want to say that I would like to be considered to be a volunteer. And that was why I made the phone call.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you very much, and good to hear from you.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So
you'll be going to the training, yeah?
I would need the training, most definitely, because it's such an emotional subject, isn't it? And so I'd need lots of training.
Potentially emotional, yes. But it sounds like they've got a framework, this whole listening thing, the active listening thing.
Yeah,
they do.
And lots of support.
And the mentors, it sounded wonderful,
yes.
Well organized, you know.
Yeah.
So, but thank you for introducing that. It was very good.
Okay, well, really
thank
nice
you.
To hear from you.
Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Back to the calendar of Cordoba. Let's look at April. April in the 10th century. And it's written in the calendar of Cordoba that April is the month when rose water, rose oil, rose syrup and rose preserves are made. Violets are picked for the making of syrup and oil, or they're pickled. Syrup is made from rue herb. There are cucumbers. The palms are artificially pollinated and the palm leaves are cut. The early grapes begin to form. The olive trees blossom. And the figs come out. The Valencian falcons hatch out of their young ones. It takes them 30 days for them to grow their feathers. The fawns are born. Supports are made for the lemon trees and jasmine cuttings are planted in the ground. The wild carrots are ripe and harvested for the making of jam. And then there are poppies, pomegranates, ox tongues and the leaves and petals of the dyer's weed from which juice is extracted. It's also the month when henna, basil, cauliflower, rice and beans are sown. The green gourds and aubergines are dug out of their forcing beds. Small melons are sown and also cucumber. Peafowl, storks and many other birds lay their eggs and begin to brood. And Stephen Nightingale, the author of this book, as I said, it's called Granada, The Light of Andalusia, goes on to say that this is poetry pressed into action as an agricultural manual. The description of each month is so detailed and affectionate and so full of a sense of wonder that one wants to take the whole text and read it out aloud month by month to friends, as we've just done with the month of April. It makes one want to keep bees and make wines, watch falcons and gather rose petals. It's yet another example of the practical labours of the period of Al-Andalus, when the result was a book people could love and use in their daily life on the land. Just such enlivening engagement is seen throughout the agricultural enterprise. What impresses is the willingness to try things out, to sift through results, to carry on for years in search of the best solution, and then to summarise the results so that other people can use them. And so we have attempts not just to list plants, but to classify them into varieties and families, and note their preferred climate and characteristics. They were detailed descriptions of a whole set of agricultural tools, 60 in all, and they even used the astrolabe to level the land in preparation for planting. I didn't know what an astrolabe was, but it's actually an instrument formerly used for measuring altitude, so it's a sort of level. They used their botanical learning as well to enrich their crops, showing, for instance, the most detailed knowledge of grafting, which is an art, as anyone who's tried it will know. But it's essential to master it if one is to breed hardy, consistent varieties of fruit trees. In the grafting, one takes the scion of wood, a cutting from the tree whose qualities you want, and join it to existing stock. One can splice the scion in or insert it into a cut directly in the trunk, which is called wedge grafting. And this art was practiced all over Al-Andalus deftly and with care and cumulative refinement of technique. It's one bit of an agricultural practice, but evocative of the devotions of the period. There's a lovely window into the life of Al-Andalus over 1,000 years ago. So 3 weeks ago, our tree of the day was the argan, which is a spiny, hawthorny type tree that grows in the desert shales of the North Sahara, the source of which is the highly prized argan oil, which is often... And the tree itself is often populated by climbing goats. And it's about these goats that a scandal is brewing, or is it?
Mm. I'll read you this article, which is in, I think it was in the Telegraph a couple of days ago. It seemed too good to be true. Visitors to Morocco have long flocked to the roads outside Marrakesh to take photographs of goats who climb into the low boughs of the argania tree. I don't know if it is Argania, but it's Argan for sure. Such pictures are widely shared on social media and often decorate the pages of guidebooks to Morocco. But an investigation by Aaron Gigoski, a British environmentalist photographer, has uncovered that the tourist destination seems to be an exploitative scam. Local farmers appear to be bringing the goats in from other areas and forcing them into the trees before charging tourists to take photographs of them. When the goats eventually tire from balancing on the tree branches, they're brought down and new goats are swapped in. After seeing tourist interest in the tree-dwelling goats, some opportunist farmers decided to manipulate the situation for financial gain. They will take the goats home in the afternoon before coaxing them back into the trees at sunrise. The goats are incredibly nimble and dexterous when it comes to navigating the trees, though generally they just stand in one place looking rather sick and forlorn. All the tourists who visited seemed blissfully unaware, though oohed and aahed before taking photos and selfies. And then, shock and horror, the goats are often rotated halfway through the day as they get tired. It's very hot work standing in a tree all day, and generally the goats are in poor condition and very skinny. Now, Chris Draper, head of animal welfare and captivity at the charity Born Free, I don't remember, Elsa the Lion, images says the images of goats and trees have become iconic, suggesting a rural idyll where crafty and agile animals have learnt to make the most of the environment. But sadly, it's turned into an exploitative setup.
I don't know what, I really don't know what to make of that. Whether, you know, well, there's so many things that in this world that you can worry about. Have you ever tried to persuade a goat to stay in a tree when it doesn't want to? Have you ever tried to persuade a goat to do anything when it doesn't want to?
Well, no, we're not for experience.
Go over there. It does, yeah. They're uncontrollable.
And it's Morocco. They're going to be skinny. They're goats. And if you were earning 4 euros a day, you'd put your goat in the tree for a photo, which somebody's going to pay you 5 euros for, wouldn't you? I would.
Goats are a bit of a theme, obviously. Today.
We had animal of the day.
Goat manure and goats in trees. And I wonder if goats are going to feature in the Spanish election, because we're going to be talking about the general election after the next break. We were going to mention the willow tree. That was our tree of the day. But sadly, I know you're all on tenterhooks to hear about the willow tree. We're going to have to leave it until next week.
Oh, no.
Because waiting in the wings after these messages is none other than Matthew Bennett.
At Home with the Hogs, with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Welcome back. For 20 years, he's been an intimate observer, not only of the Spanish political scene, but of things Spanish in general. From the Spain Report, now on the Patreon platform, the hallmark of independent journalism in Spain, Matthew Bennett. Matthew, hello and good morning.
Morning, Kit and Penny.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you with us on this auspicious occasion, because it's a general election tomorrow.
Always a pleasure. It is.
You must be on tenterhooks, mate. I mean, this is an exciting time.
Exciting to see the result, always.
Yes. Let's start with the contestants, the parties and their leaders, in the order of their poll ratings, please. Who's leading right now and what percent have they got?
Right. So with the published polls in Spain, polls are not published in the last few days of the campaign by law, so that people are freer in theory to make up their minds.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so the most recent.
Yeah, the last polls were published on Monday, and they've been flat for the whole month, stable for the whole month, okay? They haven't, the averages of the last 10 polls rolling over the last few weeks haven't budged. And leading is Pedro Sanchez and the Socialist Party on about 28-29% of the vote.
Okay, so Pedro, 28,
Pedro
20, 28,
Sanchez, Socialist Party, 28 or 29%.
Okay, let's just talk about Pedro for a little while. It seems that everybody hates him, apart from that 28%. The other candidates have
they're jealous.
Basically, united in a sort of smear against Pedro. Is that a fair impression or not?
Well, they all do it with all of. With everybody else, don't they? So that's part of politics. He's certainly not liked by the right in Spain. and certainly, but well, no, none of them like any of the other ones, do they, in public?
Okay,
fair. Sometimes it seems that they all talk to each other a bit more in private, then you see other stories that seem to suggest that actually they don't talk very much in private either, anyway.
Okay, so Pedro is in the lead in the last poll, but and next up is who?
The Popular Party, Mr. Casado, Pablo Casado.
Okay.
Spain's Conservative Party, the successor of Mariano Rajoy.
The much-loved Mariano Rajoy, yes.
Yeah, and in the published polls, they are stuck at about 20%. Stuck, which is, they haven't gone up and they haven't fallen further down either.
Right, okay, so quite a big differential there between 28 and 20.
If you believe the polls, we'll come on
to that in a moment.
Yeah, and that's going to be a big lot. If the polls are right, there's going to be a big drop for Casado and the PP, because they're currently, with the figures from 2016, the biggest party in Parliament with 137 seats. So looking at the projections off those published polls, they might be about to suffer quite a big loss anyway.
They're about to shed seats. And in third place?
Third place is Ciudadanos, the Citizens Party, with Mr. Albert Rivera.
Alberto Rivera, yes.
They are on about 15%-ish.
15
in the polls.
Presumably, they're responsible for the lessening support of PP.
Well, partly. So this is a party that started off as a regional party in Catalonia in 2006 or 2007 as a response to the left, not mm-hmm. to the right. So Ciudadanos' roots are on the left, or in social democracy in Catalonia, not as a liberal or right-wing party in the whole of Spain. So they've undergone some ideological shifts over the years, shall we say, something which Mr. Sanchez has indeed picked up on in his rallies over the last couple of weeks during the campaign, and saying that you can't trust Mr. Rivera because who knows which part of the political spectrum he's going to be on next week.
Just talking about him for a moment, the Ciudadanos, they're based in Catalonia, they've had their roots in Catalonia. Where are they with the separatists?
He gave an interview to El Mundo for the last interview of the campaign on Friday. They all did in different papers. And he was promising, he was talking about a 10-year plan for Catalonia to try to get at the underlying roots of the separatist problem, as well as the immediate notification to Mr. Torra, the leader in Catalonia at the moment, that home rule might be suspended again if he doesn't snapped attention, as it were.
Right, so he is not in any way sympathetic to potential secession of Catalonia.
No, and if you look at what happened in Andalusia, where you are, in December, all of the votes that shifted from the PP and the Socialist Party and Podemos, those three parties lost, all of those votes went to the two parties, Ciudadanos and Vox, that have most staunchly defended Spanish unity in the face of Catalan separatism.
Could you say that Ciudadanos are in favour of small business? I mean, in the TV debate last Monday, Rivera said that the self-employed always lose, and he wants to be the government
angle
for the self-employed. I like that.
Been pushing over the campaign and prior to the campaign too, so that's part of their liberal economic positioning.
It sounds encouraging to people like us who are on autonomo.
It sounds good, doesn't it?
It sounds good, yeah.
Self-employed people and small businesses, for sure, which is why they do it. Again, but that's related to their political positioning and policies and things as well.
Okay.
And they certainly push that message, yeah.
In fourth place, in the polls,
we still have Podemos and Pablo Iglesias.
Compared
to where they were, if you remember, 4 or 5 years ago, fourth place is already bad for them because they were the rising, exciting young stars 4 years ago.
Yes.
And now they've been in fourth place for all of the polls last year, up to now, still now. Beginning of March that Podemos might drop into fifth place and that Vox might shoot up past them during this campaign phase, but that hasn't happened in the end in the published polls. Podemos has managed to hang on to fourth place.
With what percentage?
About 11 or 12%. So okay. It's dropped a lot compared to where it was a couple of years ago.
So what's happened to them? Where's the disillusion?
I think a lot of it is to do with internal politics and Pablo Iglesias' leadership, and also to a couple of decisions that Pablo Iglesias made. So, for example, last year he bought a big house in a suburb of Madrid after selling a political message that was based on sort of a political scarcity and anti-austerity and public spending and all of this business. And then he became an MP, the leader of the party for a couple of years, and all of a sudden he was buying this very big, nice new house with his partner.
Doesn't take long, does it?
It wasn't such a huge house, though, was it, Matthew? Wasn't it only 600,000 euros he spent on it?
Yeah.
Do you mean only 600,000?
Well, I mean, on the Costa del Sol, that would buy you a small villa in not a very desirable part of Soto Grande. I mean, it doesn't sound like over the top to me.
Big enough, though.
Was that media spite that he should be pilloried for?
To some extent, but it was a pretty big house for an MP's salary.
Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it.
Compared to the message he said. So this is a guy who, from the beginning, walks around in cheapo Carrefour Alcampo shirts as part of his political message, not because he can't afford more expensive shirts, but because that's part of his political message. And he used to say, oh, when I become an MP and get into power and things like that, I will never leave my workers' area of Madrid for bigger things.
Jeremy Corbyn sort of buying a Knightsbridge, would that be sort of...
Exactly, and he's already done it. He's only been there for 2 or 3 years. And
he say when people said, why are you buying a big posh house?
I can't remember now. He made some excuses about it, and then I can't remember.
Okay, so anyway, his poll rating has suffered consequently.
It has. I think that's part of it, because there's just such a huge dissonance between the political message he was selling and still tries to sell, and the things that he's actually done as a leader, as well as some of the collapse internally in the party structure. So Errejón's gone. The founding members of Podemos have all gone, apart from him.
Mm-hmm.
And after that happened, that this sort of collapse has taken place. So it'll be interesting to see as well tomorrow night how big that collapse for Podemos is.
They're
currently on about 72 MPs in Parliament. So watch out and see how many MPs they end up with tomorrow night.
Okay. So we're looking at a potential loss in MPs for Pablo Casado and PP, and also Podemos.
Yeah, for the PP and Podemos, and for... Ciudadanos might add a few compared to where they were a few years ago. Anyway.
Yes. Now, I don't want to talk about Vox quite yet. We won't. Okay, I want to move on to Vox.
I was going to say, look, for Podemos numbers, they're currently at 72. They might even halve that, or more than halve that. It could be that bad for them. Yeah.
Ooh, decimation. Decimation is 1 in 10, isn't it? But bad news. At least the thing with Pablo Iglesias is that he's immediately recognisable. I mean, I think Sanchez Casado and Rivera look remarkably similar. Are the result of a sort of controlled breeding programme? I mean, they all look like the sort of guy that puts on a disposable plastic glove before filling up at a fuel station.
They certainly look very similar with their sharp haircuts and smart suits.
They really do, yeah.
Standard politicians trying to become prime minister. Pablo Iglesias certainly does look very different with his ponytails and scruff shirt.
Yes. We'll see how much of a vote catcher that is, in spite of his posh house, tomorrow. Now, politics...
He's not had a bad campaign.
Yes, how's he... He's done all right on the TV debates, yeah?
Yeah, he did okay, because, again, he sort of managed to stand out by trying to be a bit more adult than the other three. And the message he's been selling is quite a different message. He's not tried to do everything, I think, this time. He's just tried to sell a different type of anti-establishment message based on big energy companies and big media companies kind of trying to present a big conspiracy theory. But he's ended up reading the Constitution. So he used to... 5 years ago, he was very anti-constitution, anti-establishment as a whole, not just the energy companies or the media companies, and he wanted basically to trash the whole constitutional system with this anger from unemployment that there was back then.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, he's actually been getting out a copy of the Constitution in the debates and reading chunks of it on telly. So
Oh. Well, how interesting is that? He's got nothing else to say.
Interesting.
I mean, was talking of the debates, tell us your ratings on the party leaders during the televised debates.
A waste of time. I didn't learn anything new. So there was no... They were there, and the first one was too formal and too rigid and too nothing. And the second one... three of them, Casado, Rivera and Sanchez, they were just talking over each other all the time. Had to be reminded by one of the presenters at least a dozen times that they were doing it, and that when they were doing that, viewers at home couldn't even hear what they were saying.
You know, like a Spanish breakfast show on a radio.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Or like when you go out to dinner. So that's how Pablo Iglesias managed to position himself during that debate as the sort of adult figure in the room. But I didn't learn anything new, so there were no big personal questions, like big moral questions that they asked the leaders. What would you do in this terrible, terribly difficult situation when all of the options are bad? How do you think about that? What would your options be? Where would you take the country? There was nothing like that. And there was also nothing about the big, complex international stuff. No questions about Trump or Brexit or Islamic State or the state of the global economy or climate change or nothing.
Yes. And what was it good telly, though?
No complexity, no depth, no nothing. Was it good telly? Not even. It was
not even good telly. Right. So I was going to ask you for your favourite moments of the TV television debates. Nothing stands out.
No, nothing.
Okay. So politics is, as politicians are keen to remind us, politics is all about policies, although... the people they are not warts and all are inevitably more interesting. But let's go to policies now. Because on Thursday, Pablo Iglesias of Podemos said they wanted to convince us in this campaign that we had to talk about two things, Catalunya and Vox. And it seemed impossible to mention education, health and the cost of living. Right. Matthew, to what extent have Catalunya and Vox dominated the narrative of this election?
Absolutely. Even when the other parties have been trying to have them not dominate this. So take Ciudadanos, for example, which, as you rightly said a few minutes ago, is trying to sell its sort of liberal positioning, especially for self-employed and small businesses and families of all kinds and all this kind of stuff, future business, technology, that kind of angle. But if you look at point number one, in subsection one, in paragraph one of its actual election manifesto, what's in that first point? Catalonia and the suspension of home rule again. Why? Because Vox already went to the most extreme position that any of the political parties could have adopted on that months ago,
and took them to court.
A radical suspension of home rule and getting rid of all of the organisations that might...
And a lawsuit, indeed. Didn't they? They've taken them to court. I mean,
Vox has been a party to the prosecution.
Again, I want to talk about Vox later. Separatism...
It all comes back to Vox this year.
Yes, we're working up to that climax.
Like Podemos did in 2015.
Yeah.
It just does.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait. Let's talk about separatism, though,
okay.
Because Vox is not a policy.
Vox is not a policy.
No, it's not, is it? I mean, it might be an
Vox
issue.
Is a party.
But it's a party. Separatism, party. Though, very much is a policy. I mean, how relevant is it that the four main parties all chose Barcelona for their closing campaign rallies?
They didn't.
They didn't?
No.
Oh, I thought they did. I read in El País yesterday.
Abascal was in Madrid.
No, Abascal, yeah, but I don't include him. Should I say, no, the four main parties.
In Madrid, and, yeah, no, they didn't.
Okay. Oh, well, that blows that away. Catalonia, though, how does the general election manifest there, briefly? Are there Catalan independent parties in the hat in the general election, like the Scottish Nationalists fight?
Absolutely. Okay. And that's actually one of the... If we're going to sort of criticise the debates and the election campaigns and the way politics works in Spain, that's another part of the system that could be legitimately criticised or improved upon. So the way the system is set up, the Basque nationalists and the Catalan nationalists have more weight in the system than other regions in Spain do. So there will be about 30 or so regional nationalist MPs elected between the two regions, and the Canary Islands normally gets one as well.
But they won't all. They won't sit in a block like the Scottish National. The Scottish Nationalists do in Westminster, which always seems to me to be...
They come from different parties. So if you look at Catalonia, you've got Catalan separatist parties, which is a Republican Catalan left, Esquerra, and the Puigdemont party, whatever that's called now. It's changed its name about five times over the past...
Okay, so these guys are competing in the general election.
What used to be Catalan conservatives, but then went radical separatist with Mas and Puigdemont. They compete among themselves, but since the separatist crisis began, or since it all began gathering steam in 2012, they've had the same basic position on separatism, on independence. So that makes them a bloc, but they don't sit as a bloc and they don't run as a bloc. They run as separate parties and then send their MPs to Madrid.
Okay. Let's talk about policies continuing and leave out the Catalan secession. Obviously, immigration, unemployment... Mm. Health, yeah. Education, yeah. Rural communities and depopulation we talked yeah. about earlier. And looking at these issues and the basic correlation of policies from the various parties, is it possible to see a pattern of alliances emerging that could suggest a possible future coalition?
You've got blocks. So this is related to the fragmentation of the political system as a whole. So now we're going to five main parties plus the regional nationalist parties, and basically you've got two blocks still, left and right. The left bloc is basically gone. The right calls it Frankenstein or the enemies of Spain, because they say it's Sanchez and the socialists now with Podemos and with the regional nationalists who want to undo Spain or break Spain and turn it into a communist super state that's something akin to Venezuela and Maduro. Mm. And then on the right, you've got the three right-wing parties, which Ciudadanos is normally included in. Ciudadanos, the PP, and Vox, which the left characterizes as the three fascist right-wing parties who want to turn Spain into some new version of Franco.
Okay, so it's likely that what we're going to end up is a coalescence of one of those blocks.
Possibly. Ciudadanos is going to have a problem in the middle, because of that transition it's had in its history and the positioning it has and the messaging it has anyway. At the minute, it's in that block of three right-wing parties because that's where its voters are, mostly. But if Sanchez wins and he could stay in power with the support of Ciudadanos and nobody else, then you might get an option which would be a kind of centre-left liberal thing, which they tried in 2015, 2016, but Podemos wouldn't go for it then.
Okay, so Ciudadanos could swing both ways.
Yeah.
Just briefly, Matthew, because we still haven't talked about Vox, yesterday's editorial of El País newspaper made the point that policies on the environment have been conspicuously absent from the debates. What's that say about people's consciousness here?
I don't think it says much about people's consciousness. I think it says a lot about politicians' consciousness and the media. It's what we were saying a minute ago about the lack of global complexity or questions in the debates. It's not just climate change, it's all the rest of it too. There was just nothing at all about the world in the debates. That it says more about the media and politicians, I think, than it says about Spaniards, who just as interested in the world as any other country is. But... I think it's something that should change in public debate generally, but it depends on the media and the politicians.
Yes, okay. So not allowed to debate and campaigning outside the mainstream media, but according to Graham Keighley in yesterday's Times, on course to win 30 seats tomorrow, Vox, the elephant outside the room.
Could be more than that, even.
Yes, I'm going to ask you for your predictions.
Yeah, it could be. I mean,
and are they on course to change the political landscape here in Spain?
If I had to bet, I would say yes, they are. The question is how much they're going to change it tomorrow night. So, yes, Vox is coming. How many seats are they going to win? How many MPs are they going to end up with tomorrow night? And there, nobody has a clue. You've got polls that say different things. The private polls this week, I've talked to a couple of people about those, who know some of the numbers, and but there was no consistency over the numbers for the ones that I talked about or asked about. So it's just a question of how much Vox Spain is going to get, really.
Okay, so
let's... The inconsistency between the published polls, and the sort of media buzz and social buzz and the buzz at the rallies and the excitement and things like that, it doesn't fit in the case of Vox. Something's missing. So either the media buzz and the media narrative and the story and the online stuff is wrong and it's overhyped, or the published polls have completely missed it.
Well, watch this space. Let's talk about Vox now then. Santiago Abascal is their leader. Does he carry a pistol?
No, that's about... He used to carry a pistol because... I don't know if he still does. He used to carry a pistol because he was allowed to, because he was a terror target for ETA for many years. And it comes from the Basque Country. He was a politician in the Basque Country, so he was allowed to.
He's a Basque, is he?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was in politics in the Basque Country for many years and threatened by ETA, so he was allowed to. That's not a sort of... Second Amendment gun right nutter thing.
Okay. Now, they wound up their campaign in Valencia, and yesterday's El País uses the word guerra civilista to describe the tone of his speech, alluding to the enemy, the other parties, as separatists. Now, I wonder if you can translate this, because I haven't had a chance. Proetarras?
Right.
What does that mean?
ETA supporters.
Okay. Burguesitos de Barcelona. Burgers of Barcelona, is that?
The bourgeois
of Barcelona. Okay.
Bourgeois.
Progressistas, right. Liberals. Yes.
Liberals if you're American, progressives, left wing if you're European.
De Os y Martillo. Os?
Communists. The hammer and sickle.
Right. Great. Yes. Okay. So this is quite inflammatory language, isn't it? And
because it's El País talking about Vox. So if you look at, well, I don't know if you saw yesterday, I'll send you a photo today if you want. But the El País online papers in Spain support their candidates on the last day. So El País was an interview with Sanchez, El Mundo had an interview with Rivera,
yes.
ABC had an interview with Casado. Okay. But El País went way over the top, and on the online homepage it won for most of the day yesterday, there was the interview with Sanchez, obviously with a photo of Sanchez. There was also a story about Casado saying Vox would get into his coalition government if that happened on the right. And then there's another story, the third story at the top of the homepage was the international media, the FT and The Economist, warning about Vox, okay? And then mixed in with the editorial stories, which all happen to be about Vox, and Sanchez warning about Vox, foreign media warning about Vox, Casado saying Vox would be in a right-wing coalition, they covered the front page with Socialist Party adverts, with a big red adverts with Sanchez's face right there, and the simple message, vote PSOE. So they went right over the top. So you have to understand El País's comments about Vox in that.
I understand. Right. Yes, it is left of centre. It's a sort of Guardian read, isn't it?
It used to be. It's also shifted and changed over the past few years. It used to be comparable to the Guardian. Heaven knows where it is at the minute.
But it's certainly not pro Vox, Matthew.
No.
So we need to wind up because goodness me, look at the time. It's nearly 1 o'clock. So when we talk next Saturday,
You've
kindly agreed to come back and
we will
debrief us on this election. Whom do you think we will be talking about, Matthew Bennett? Ultimate punditry time. Your predictions for tomorrow's general election.
Vox. It wouldn't be impossible. Nobody knows how many seats Vox is going to win. Okay, Vox is coming. Vox is going to win a chunk of seats. Nobody knows how big the chunk of seats is going to be. I said yesterday, if you had a phone, well, you are phoning up to ask now. I wouldn't rule out second place for Vox.
Really?
Wow.
I don't know. But the way the polls are and the way the media buzz is and the social stuff and the stuff from the rallies, I wouldn't say it's impossible. Nobody thinks they're going to win. Everybody thinks that the Socialist Party is going to be the first place. Even though they don't get an overall majority,
but Vox may be the main party of opposition. Matthew, we're going to have to leave it.
I wouldn't say it's impossible.
That we're going to have to leave it. Fascinating stuff. We're on tenterhooks. Thank you so much for illuminating this fascinating political content. The results of which will be known tomorrow. At what sort of time?
The real results are normally out at about 10 p.m. So if you want, you can watch them. Your listeners can watch them online as they're published. Exit polls at 8 p.m. when the polls close. Real results start flowing in about half an hour later. Actual final results are normally there by about 10, 10.30.
Great, mate. Thank you so much. We'll speak to you next week. Enjoy the day.
Pleasure, Kit and Penny.
Bye-bye now.
Bye, Matthew.
That's all from us. Have a wonderful weekend. Bertie the Blackbird wishes you a wonderful weekend as well.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.